Banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. Taking a look at our current temperatures, it is 57 in Grand Rapids, 61 in Brainerd, 62 in Bemidji, 54 right now in Hibbing. For today, we can expect a chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly late this afternoon and into the evening, increasing clouds as we go throughout the day, highs near 80, southeast winds around 5 miles per hour. Showers and thunderstorms likely tonight with lows 54 to 58. And for tomorrow, gradually clearing, highs 76 to 80, slight chance for showers. Lows tomorrow night in the mid to upper 50s, and looking ahead to Wednesday, mostly sunny, highs 78 to 82. We want to remind you that Lake Bemidji State Park has reopened with limited access. The campground beach and most trails south of Birchmont Beach Road are now open. Other trails and the fishing pier remain closed until further notice. You can always find the latest by searching for Lake Bemidji State Park. It is time now for the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Unlike its neighbors, Minnesota law forbids the usage of aerial exploding fireworks unless you're a municipality or fair association with a permit and a licensed operator. But that doesn't stop trunks and backseats full of illicit products from crossing Minnesota's borders each summer. MinPost reports charges and convictions for violations of the law are rare, but they do happen. Statewide, there's only been between 40 and 90 charges a year and 20 to 60 convictions. Fireworks legalization is regularly proposed at the legislature. It made it as far as the governor's desk in 2012 before Mark Dayton vetoed it, citing opposition from the state fire marshal and public safety officials. Republican Senator Jason Rarick of Pine City authored one such bill in January. He says current laws don't stop Minnesotans from using fireworks, but they do push money out of the state. Rarick tells MinPost he plans to keep proposing legalization and says safety education campaigns could go with it, as well as options for local control. An environmental group is suing to stop construction on a tailings basin expansion near Lake Superior. The Duluth News Tribune reports Water Legacy sued the Department of Natural Resources and Cleveland Cliffs-owned North Shore Mining Co. last month. The group alleges North Shore violated the State Environmental Policy Act by allowing construction before the completion of an environmental impact statement. The Milepost 7 tailings basin near Beaver Bay is 3 miles from Lake Superior and holds back mine waste. Last year, the DNR said a more limited environmental assessment worksheet was enough for the basin's planned 650-acre expansion and dam elevation increase. But in February, the Court of Appeals ruled the DNR erred in its decision and had to reevaluate. The DNR then told North Shore it could continue construction as long as it complied with existing permits. The News Tribune says Water Legacy moved for a temporary restraining order to bar the DNR from awarding the project more approvals and the company from continuing construction. The group says the dam is 45 years old and does not meet modern safety standards. The DNR is updating bait restriction rules to match legislative changes. The new rules define what species are susceptible to viral hemorrhagic septicemia and allows the establishment of VHS-free zones. People who harvest bait to use dead or frozen may be affected. Comments are open until 4:30 p.m. Tuesday. The DNR is also seeking public input on proposed fisheries changes. The agency is considering reducing the statewide walleye limit from 6 to 4. It says this is a proactive step in maintaining quality walleye fishing. You can share your thoughts through August 15th at mndnr.gov/walleye. Find more on all of those on the DNR's website. A new skate park in Brainerd is closer than ever to completion. The Brainerd Dispatch reports the Minnesota legislature awarded $750,000 for the project at Memorial Park in northeast Brainerd. Skating has been growing in popularity. Jake Reneker is president of the Lakes Area Skate Park Association. He says the park is a way to promote healthy recreation and an economic driver. Right now, the nearest skate park is in Crosby. The legislature awarded $4 million to 8 skate park projects, with Brainerd receiving the largest contribution. According to MinnPost, skate parks got the most general fund money of any projects, with the legislature making cuts this year that may raise some eyebrows. But MinnPost says the money was actually first appropriated in 2023, and this was more of a redirection of the funding. Brainerd is planning a 15,000-square-foot park and must spend the state dollars by 2029. The Dispatch says the Lakes Area Skate Park Association is in its final push for donations to get the last $150,000 it needs. The group will have a booth at the Crow Wing County Fair and is planning a fundraiser this fall. It says naming rights are still up for grabs, too. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
You can hear the latest edition of the Up North Report today at 5:30 during All Things Considered here on KAXE. You can also find lots of local stories and conversations at our website, kaxe.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show. Coming up at 9 o'clock today, Heather Johnson, your host for Headwaters. She is taking your requests on the request line. She'll play a set at 10:30. She wants to hear your suggestions of songs about yodeling. What do you think? Text us, 218-326-1234. You can also answer our question of the week. We want to hear about your favorite things to do in or on the water. Do you like swimming, fishing, water skiing, paddleboarding? We want to hear all about it. Text 218-326-1234. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji. Huff's congregation strives to build bridges with the community and welcomes all to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. We also thank the Children's Discovery Museum in Grand Rapids, offering a hands-on learning environment for children to develop skills and grow their imagination with a new Bear Cave and Ojibwe Constellation exhibit and a kid-sized credit union to learn banking concepts. Hours and weekly programming available at cdmkids.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. President Trump says there could be a ceasefire deal in Gaza this week, with some hostages in Gaza going free.
I think there's a good chance we have a deal with Hamas during the coming week, pertaining to quite a few of the hostages.
That's what Trump will be discussing this evening with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the White House. It will be their first meeting since the U.S. joined Israel in attacking Iran's nuclear sites 2 weeks ago.
NPR's Daniel Estrin has been following all this from Tel Aviv. Daniel, good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
So how close is a ceasefire deal in Gaza based on your reporting?
We are not expecting a ceasefire deal to be announced today. It could take a few more days or longer. Israel and Hamas just began talks in Doha, Qatar yesterday, and mediators in the region tell us that the Israeli and Hamas delegations are on different floors of the same hotel in Doha, and mediators are shuttling between them. But remember, Netanyahu just landed today in Washington. A person who was briefed on the matter, who was not authorized to speak publicly, told me that Netanyahu is expected to meet Trump's Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio to talk over the details of what a Gaza deal would look like before Netanyahu meets Trump for dinner.
Can you just give us a sense of what a ceasefire deal might look like? I mean, is it temporary? Would it actually lead to the end of the war in Gaza?
We saw a recent draft of the deal that is being negotiated. It starts with a 60-day ceasefire. During that time, Hamas would release 10 out of the 20 living hostages it still holds. Israel would release Palestinian prisoners. And starting on day one of the ceasefire, the two sides would begin discussing the terms of a final end of the war. Now, Netanyahu's latest mantra is that there will be no more Hamas in Gaza. So we are expecting discussions between the U.S. and Israel this week in Washington about about what that would look like. Does that mean expelling the few remaining senior Hamas militants from Gaza? What would it look like for Hamas to lay down its arms? Who would replace Hamas in governing Gaza? Those are the issues that need to be discussed.
So it was just 2 weeks ago that the U.S. joined Israel's attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities. Now Trump is looking for a ceasefire deal in Gaza. Is this all connected, Daniel? Is there a bigger strategy at play here?
I think it is all connected, Michelle. We spoke to a person briefed on the matter who was not authorized to speak about it publicly, who said that Netanyahu and Trump will be discussing what kind of diplomatic deal Israel would want to see with Iran, what would want the U.S. to forge with Iran over the future of its nuclear program. You know, Trump did attack Iran's nuclear sites with bombs that Israel does not possess. That is something Netanyahu had long wanted, and now Netanyahu knows what Trump wants. Trump wants an end to the Gaza war. Trump promised his voters when he was running for election that he would end wars. He wants to be the president to end the Gaza war so that he can broker diplomatic ties between Israel and other Arab or Muslim countries. But that puts Netanyahu in a tough spot. His far-right political partners in government do not want the war to end. But for Netanyahu, ending the war and freeing the hostages from Gaza is a kind of image of victory that could help Netanyahu. He is eyeing a potential new election here in Israel.
That is NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Daniel, thank you.
You're welcome.
To get into more about what's at stake with these negotiations for a ceasefire, we're joined by Hussein Ibish. He's a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, D.C. Hussein, good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Led.
So there have been so many failed negotiations in the past. At this point, has something changed? Do both Netanyahu's government and the Hamas leadership actually want a deal?
It's hard to say about Israel. Hamas leaders do want a deal as long as it leads to an end to the war and the removal of Israeli troops from all or almost all of Gaza. And that's really their overriding goal. Whether the Israelis really want to end the war or not is the big unanswered question, because Netanyahu, from the beginning, has set an impossible goal, which is the elimination of Hamas. That Hamas is not a list of people who can be killed and items that can be destroyed. It's a political brand. So it really, you know, would require Israel to make some fundamental decisions about where it's going and its relationship, not just with Gaza, but with all of the Palestinians into the coming decades.
What do you expect to happen this week?
Well, I think it's likely that we'll get progress towards a ceasefire. We may even get a ceasefire. But the question is, will it be more interesting and more enduring than the last one? The last one, which was at the beginning part of this year, lasted for 60 days, just about, that it was supposed to last for. And this is sort of a redux of that. But then Netanyahu sort of broke it unilaterally with an extremely violent attack that killed about 80 Palestinians and a very large number of them children. And then the war was back on. And so one of the big questions is, you know, whether Israel is going to commit to something that will endure beyond that period of time. And that's, I think, one of Hamas's big holdouts.
Has the appointment of Izzeddin al-Haddad as a new Hamas leader in Gaza changed anything?
I don't think al-Haddad changes anything. I think he's clearly the leader because there are so few left. And he does apparently play a role, a significant role, in deciding Hamas's response to these proposals, because the gunmen on the ground in Gaza still have the predominant power in the organization, not the political figures in exile in Turkey and in Qatar. But, you know, in the end, he's not an experienced leader, and he's not a visionary, so he just represents more of the same.
You say the elimination of Hamas is not a realistic goal. I mean, what is a realistic goal so that Israelis have security, Palestinians have security, and this war can end?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a clear formula to it, which is for Israel to withdraw, for Hamas to recede from government and to allow the creation of an alternative Palestinian civic administration. But the Israelis have been resisting this for well over a year now, because in the end, Palestinian politics are binary, right? And anything that strengthens Hamas is likely to weaken the PLO and the PA in Ramallah, vice versa. So if there is an alternative to Hamas created, it will derive its strength from the PLO and the PA in Ramallah, and that Israel fears, because they could eventually create a Palestinian state. And that's Israel's biggest concern. The overriding goal in the end is, I think, annexation of the West Bank.
Hossein Ibish is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute. Thank you for your time.
You're so welcome, Leila. Thank you.
The Justice Department says it is aggressively prioritizing efforts to strip citizenship from naturalized U.S. citizens who commit certain crimes. It's the latest effort by the Trump administration to reshape the nation's immigration system. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz has the story.
When an immigrant becomes a naturalized citizen in the United States, they vow to support and defend the Constitution, as can be heard in this naturalization ceremony from 2019.
That I will support and defend,
that I will support and defend,
the Constitution and laws,
the Constitution and laws
of the United States.
Laura Bingham, a law professor at Temple University, says these individuals become naturalized citizens, gaining the perceived protection and finality of American citizenship.
And it's not supposed to be something that you can continuously open up for some people and you can't for others.
But certain naturalized citizens could be at risk under a new memo from the Justice Department. U.S. attorneys are being told to prioritize denaturalization, or revoking citizenship, in cases involving naturalized citizens who commit certain crimes. Those crimes could include anything from national security incidents to cases of fraud. And the DOJ is also giving U.S. attorneys wider discretion on when to pursue denaturalization.
So to see that this administration is plotting out how they're going to expand its use in ways that we have not seen before is very shocking and very concerning.
That was Samira Hafiz with the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, a national advocacy organization. In our nation's history, revoking someone's citizenship was traditionally used in cases involving war criminals, Nazis, or communists. The Justice Department said in an email to NPR that denaturalization will only be pursued in cases where, quote, a person illegally procured or misrepresented facts in the naturalization process. And the agency says it's committed to maintaining the integrity of the naturalization program. Cassandra Robertson, a law professor at Case Western Reserve University, says the peak of denaturalization was during the McCarthy era, when it was used as a tool to target political enemies. It came up again during the Obama administration. Now, Robertson is concerned that the DOJ memo also says that the government will pursue denaturalization cases through civil litigation.
Where the individual is not entitled to an attorney, where there's no statute of limitations, and the person might not even have known that a proceeding was filed against them.
For example, Elliot Duke is an American military veteran originally from the UK who lost their citizenship in recent weeks. They were convicted for receiving and possessing child sexual abuse material. We spoke with Duke. They said they were served denaturalization papers while in prison back in February. The proceedings over their citizenship happened in another state without them present and without a lawyer. Here's Laura Bingham again.
I see really grave risks with starting to open up these kinds of conversations about who belongs.
Bingham said that regardless of the crimes Duke committed, the situation sets a dangerous precedent. Duke, who has years to go in their prison term, is now effectively stateless. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is KAXE and the Monday Morning Show at 7:19. I'm Jennifer Barr with Sarah Bignall. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. It is a sunny morning out and a little cool. I think it's good sleeping weather, though, from some of the hot temperatures we've had.
Yeah. It was still felt a little stuffy in my house last night, just because I think that it had been, you know, holding on to some of that heat.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a lot cooler than it was.
that it is. Yeah. And looking ahead to the week ahead, it looks like we have some warmer temperatures, a typical summer in northern Minnesota.
Yeah, let's see. Today, we do have a chance of showers and thunderstorms coming in probably late this afternoon into the early evening. Increasing clouds as we go throughout our day. Highs near 80 and southeast winds around 5 miles per hour. Showers and thunderstorms likely tonight. Lows 54 to 58. And then gradually clearing tomorrow. Highs 76 to 80 and a slight chance for showers. And looking ahead to Wednesday, mostly sunny. Highs 78 to 82.
So coming up today on the morning show, we'll have some best wishes. And what else do we got going on, Jennifer?
We're going to hear a rebroadcast of a What We're Reading conversation. Tammy Bobrowski talks with Minnesota author Kent Nerburn, formerly of the Bemidji area, on his new novel, Lone Dog Road. And then coming up 9 o'clock, Headwaters with Heather Johnson.
And what was the mixtape or the question?
The request line.
Oh, yodels.
Songs about yodeling.
Okay.
All I could think of was The Price is Right.
Like, oh, the little guy that goes up.
Hanger climber.
Yeah. So does Orville Peck kind of yodel in some of his?
Yeah, I think so. Also, I just thought of like Woodblind.
The
Tree Party. Some of those like more local bands kind of incorporate a little yodely sound.
And that big voice. I think that they have a song.
Okay.
Where I got a big, and that kind of has some yodeling in it.
Yep.
Well, that'll be interesting.
So if you have yodeling suggestions, text us 218-326-1234. Also, our question of the week is, what are your favorite things to do in or on the water?
Yeah, this is I don't mind swimming and that sort of stuff, but I'm not one that like actively seeks it out.
I don't either. I really am not much of a swimmer. I have not. Last summer, I had my swimming suit on for a bit, but I didn't actually go swimming. I was maybe going to, but then it was kind of like threatening weather, so I didn't.
Okay.
But yeah, it had been a long time since I even had been wearing a swimsuit. So
a swimsuit. Yeah. I've enjoyed like paddle boating, you know. My grandparents had like a
where you paddled a
You know, that was kind of fun to tool around. I've tried like upright paddle boarding.
Yeah.
And it's really fun until you get like slightly like off balance, and then it's just like you get shaky and I fling myself into the lake, and I'm impressed with the people who can just glide and look very stable.
Effortless.
Yeah. I'm not that. Like going on a boat ride and stuff like that's kind of fun, but
There are some things I would like to try. I just don't have the equipment and I don't really want to invest in the equipment. Things, especially when you don't live on water.
Yeah.
Like kayaking seems really fun, or stand-up paddleboarding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You could rent them, I think.
That's true.
There are places you could do that. Or find a friend that has.
And when I was young, sometimes my parents and I would rent a paddle boat from a local resort. You could go in and do that. But the lake that resort was on was very lily pad-ish, it was get difficult.
Yeah, that's not fun. That once you get those lily pads caught around like the rudder or whatever, it kind of slows the progress down.
Yeah,
but that's what we're talking this week is what's your favorite activity to do on the water? We have lots of lakes around here for people to get out and recreate in.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's just floating. Sometimes that's just nice.
Floating just kind of sitting on a dock and dangling your feet in can be a nice thing.
Yeah. The fish in the water kind of creep me out though, you know, and we've been to some of the lakes around here that like all those like little minnow-y kind of things by the shore, and they're like around your feet. Let us know. You can text us what your favorite part of, water, being on the water is 218-326-1234.
It is time for Events Up North. It's a closer look at some of the events happening across northern Minnesota this week.
The Bemidji Senior Center invites us to the Oodle of Noodles and Yankee Doodles fundraiser tonight at 6 o'clock. You can enjoy a spaghetti dinner followed by a patriotic concert by the First City Singers.
And it is Big Truck Day at the Virginia Public Library, Thursday, July 10th from 10:30 to noon. You can see big machines and the vehicles that help keep our community safe. This is probably geared toward like younger kids, but I, you know, anybody can enjoy a big truck. And also Fifth Avenue will be blocked off in front of the library for this event.
Itasca Waters continues their Practical Water Wisdom webinar series on Thursday, July 10th at noon. This month, it's Dr. Daniel Larkin. We'll talk about the invasive starry stonewort. And you can tune in tomorrow morning at 8:45. We'll have a conversation with Dr. Larkin.
And Heartland Arts presents the Northwind Clarinets on Thursday, 12:15 at Calvary Lutheran Church in Park Rapids. They will play a variety of genres on many different sized clarinets. Now, I wish I lived a little closer to Park Rapids because I am a clarinet.
Okay.
A former clarinet player.
Yes.
And I think it would be very interesting, especially I know of a clarinet and a bass clarinet, but I think they have even different sizes than that. So it would be very interesting.
I'm a little intrigued because like they have like a contrabass saxophone, which is giant, like a giant saxophone. And so I would assume like that. And like there's a soprano saxophone as well. Mm-hmm. So like in the clarinet family, I'm going to make an assumption that they have similar, you know, instruments, right?
Right.
Huh.
Yes.
Well, you can go check that out. Was that Thursday? Thursday at 12:15. Okay.
Yep.
The Friends of the Grand Rapids Area Library have their annual summer book sale that is going on Friday, July 11th from 10 to 6 and Saturday, July 12th from 9 until 5 at the Community Presbyterian Church.
And Pequot Lakes Community Theater presents Roald Dahl's Willy Wonka starting this Friday and going through July 20th at Pequot Lakes High School Theater. Friday shows at 7 p.m., Saturday and Sunday shows at 2 o'clock.
The McCroskey Arts Center presents its annual Downtown Art Fair on Saturday, July 12th from 9 to 4 on the grounds of Old Central School in Grand Rapids, with over 40 regional artists, food vendors, and hands-on activities, as well as live music.
And Northland Arboretum in Brainerd has a soft grand opening and fundraiser for their new bike park. This Saturday, noon to 5, food and beverage will be available for purchase. Plus, you can play yard games and try the trails. Protective gear like helmets are required if you are going to be riding a bike.
And the Park Rapids Water Ski Team performs on Saturday, July 12th at 6 p.m. at the Helverson Beach in Nevis. Bring your own chair or beach towel. Events Up North is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the Citizens of Minnesota. If you have events to share with our listeners, you can email psa@kaxe.org and look for Events Up North at kaxe.org every week.
We're going to listen now to our album of the week. We get to kick it off. It's by Robert Randolph. It's called Preacher Kids. And this is his first album without the family band.
I was going to say, I've known him with the family band. So.
Yep, this is a solo, although he's got lots of guests and everyone on the record is a preacher's kid.
Okay.
And the song we're going to hear is called King Karma, and it just happens to feature this year's Grand Rapids Riverfest performer Margo Price on this one as well by Robert Randolph.
Come on.
That is from our album of the week. The album's called Preacher Kids by Robert Randolph, and that one did feature Margo Price. We'll be hearing more of that album as we go throughout the week here on KAXE. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr with Sarah Bignall.
And we've received support from the Minnesota Board of Aging's Legal Kiosk, offering no-charge assistance with housing benefits, custody, and more. Legal Kiosk, located in libraries and trusted local community spaces, connecting Minnesotans with legal information and virtual meeting access in some locations. Court forms can be printed at no cost. Help is available in many languages. More online at legalkiosk.org.
We also thank Sanford Health with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org.
And we also receive support from Minnesota Power, an elite company envisioning a carbon-free future through their Energy Forward strategy, or at mmpower.com/energyforward.
Temperatures right now, it's warmed up to 64 degrees in Bemidji, 55 in Hibbing, 59 in Aiken, 61 in Park Rapids and Brainerd, and 59 in Grand Rapids. We do have a chance of showers and thunderstorms today, mostly late this afternoon and into the evening. Increasing clouds today, highs near 80, southeast winds around 5 miles per hour. Showers and thunderstorms likely overnight, lows 54 to 58, and then tomorrow gradually clearing, highs 76 to 80, slight chance for showers.
The KAXE Newsroom has created a map of northern Minnesota's farmers markets throughout the region, from places like Park Rapids to Palo, Talmoon to Reamer, and Black Duck to Crosby. Most markets run through September or October. You can find that map at our website, kaxe.org.
It is time now for best wishes. We're going to do our best to wish friends and neighbors happy birthday, happy anniversary. Let's start with yesterday, July 6th.
So Xander and Anissa Grochon are celebrating their 29th anniversary in Grand Rapids. And Michael and Karen
McAvoy,
there you go, their 17th anniversary in Nashwalk. And Richard German, or Germain, do you think German?
German, I believe.
Okay. He's celebrating his 70th birthday in Pequot Lakes. Randy Nelson is turning 73 in Prior Lake. Lori Lloyd is celebrating a birthday today in Grand Rapids, along with Julie Johnson, who's turning 64.
And today is July 7th. Happy anniversary to Andy and Sheila Fayak from Brainerd. Julie May, happy 77th birthday to you in Fort Ripley. Tom Boland turning 76 today in Effie. And Scott Dahlquist, happy 69th in Chisholm. Also, I need to mention Ringo Starr turning 85 today.
Okay.
Just because, you know, me and the Beatles.
Oh, yeah.
Peace and love. Our best wishes to you all. If you have birthday or anniversary greetings to share, you can always text in and let us know, 218-326-1234.
So do you have some Ringo Starr queued up here to
go? I actually don't.
Okay.
Didn't think that far ahead.
Oh, no.
But I've got some Jeremy Albino.
Oh, awesome. Another. He's part of Grand Rapids Riverfest. That's coming up on September 6th, along with Courtney Barnett, Margo Price, and Alan Sparhawk.
Yeah, find your tickets and more information at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. Yesterday, it occurred to me we are just 2 months away.
Yep, it is barreling down on us. I can't believe that we're at the kind of midpoint of summer, or, you know, where it's fall will be there here before we know it.
Yeah, summer flies.
Uh-huh.
So here is Jeremy Albino. This one's called All These Days.
All the snow is gone, and they say the spring has sprung. Finally see the sunlight in your eyes. Take you for a ride, or we'll just stay inside. Either way, I'm happy by your side. All these days, we sit out in the sun. All the ways, you show me how to love. Seasons change. Someday we'll go up, but I'll never take for granted in all these days. Never mind the cold, the troubles or the road. You always see the world in silver lines. And when I'm in the rough, you just smile and pull me up. You take my heart and open up the blinds. All these days we sit out in the sun. All the ways, oh, you show me how to love. Seasons change, someday we'll grow up, but I'll never take for granted all these days. Show me how to love. Seasons change. Someday we'll grow up, but I'll never take granted all these days. No, I'll never take for granted all these days.
Music there from Jeremy Albino. All These Days. That's from his 2023 album, Tears You Hide. We are so excited to have him at Grand Rapids River Fest.
Yeah, I think every year there's kind of the one surprise artist that people maybe are a little unfamiliar with and then come and are blown away. I think he might be it.
For sure. One of last year's performers, S.G. Goodman, was playing in Duluth on Saturday with Trampled by Turtles at Bayfront, and saw some photos from that from a friend who went, and it looked like a great time.
I've heard wonderful things for that concert, and it's such a great venue too. They're right mm-hmm. on Lake Superior, and I was in Duluth on the 4th of July, and there was a 20 degree difference from the mm-hmm. top of the hill to like the, you know, along lakeside there.
Yeah.
That it was very pleasant. You almost needed a sweatshirt. You're like, ooh, it's a little chilly down here.
That is the best feeling after you've been through some like hot weather to be like, ooh, it's a little chilly.
It's a little chilly. Yeah. And we made our way up to Split Rock Lighthouse. And I had gone like in elementary school as like a tour, and I haven't been back since.
Okay.
And that was actually quite interesting. Just some of the, you know, just ships on Lake Superior, like modern day transportation is just so vastly different from what existed. And, you know, it was even just 100 years ago, you know, like the mm-hmm. highways and, you know.
Yeah. Even getting that road up the north shore of Lake Superior was quite the effort.
Yeah. And so it was, they had to like ship everything in to the lighthouse. So the lighthouse keepers could have supplies, and mm-hmm. then they had like a big crane. So that was like the first thing that they brought up to like the lighthouse was like this crane that could help, you know, pull supplies up. And then that's how they got all of the materials,
like
then
all the bricks.
And all of that to build all of these things, they had to ship them in and
like hoist them all up that big cliff.
And even like the lighthouse, like the light itself was like made in, you know, Paris. It was so they imported that from France. Right. But, and so like now we can pick up the phone or send an email and you're like, oh, I want to order this thing. And so they're probably having to correspond, you know, via like letter. Like how long did that take to like coordinate all of that?
Yeah.
I don't know. And like the light like could shine like 22 miles. Like how bright is a light to, I don't know, just incredible. I'm amazed at how like engineering over the years of just like that's amazing.
Yeah. And what an important role those lighthouses played. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Crazy.
I don't know. So anyways, that was being a tourist in northern Minnesota is, my husband and I, we've got e-bikes. Like it's been exactly a year now, but we've been able to visit, you know, towns that we, you know, wouldn't think to go to, but we mm-hmm. were biking through and we're like, we're going to be tourists in northern Minnesota and kind of check things out. And I don't know. We live in a pretty cool place.
We do. And I just was sensing a future question of the week throughout that, like, you know, the best places in your that you either want to go or want to show other people. But we'll save that for another question of the week. But right now we want to know about your favorite things to do on the water. Mm-hmm. That is our question of the week.
I think swimming in Lake Superior, like they had we were watching like the local news and they were like, a reminder, it might be hot air temperature wise, but Lake Superior is still going to be like 50 degrees. So like before you launch yourself into that, it's going to be cold.
It will be shocking.
It'll take your breath away.
We just heard from Mary and Cass Lake, who said, good morning, Jennifer, good morning, Sarah. Lovely morning, isn't it? And yes, indeed it is.
Yes, and I did not get my full dog walk this morning, so looking forward to getting that in this afternoon, hopefully before it rains.
Yeah, I think you should have time for that.
Okay.
Support comes from the Green Heron Bed and Breakfast, a four-season B&B on Pickhagama Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities for a complete family vacation. More information at greenheronbnb.com.
We also receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients in real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com.
Phenology is the rhythmic biological nature of events as they relate to climate. It is time for John Latimer to look back at his nature notes for this date.
On today's date, July the 7th, in the year 2003, the Juneberries are ripe. Juneberries are a rather interesting plant because they flower simultaneously, synchronously. They are all in flower at once. And this provides the bees with a sort of absolutely a smorgasbord of flowers to get nectar from and to get pollen from. And it provides the Juneberries with a completely solitary blossom in the fact that there are no other plants blooming at the same time, and the bees can focus on only the Juneberry. Though they flower simultaneously, synchronously, they fruit asynchronously. So you're going to have one ripe Juneberry here and another ripe Juneberry over there. Meanwhile, all the other Juneberries on the plant are going to be somewhere between being green and being ripe. And that makes it difficult for you and I to harvest Juneberries because the robins are checking the Juneberries every couple of minutes and making sure that any ripe Juneberry ends up in their mouth. And we check the Juneberries every couple of days, hoping that suddenly they'll all be ripe and we can pick enough for a pie. It never quite works out that way.
That is our daily dose of phenology. You can tune in tomorrow morning, 7:20. John Latimer will have his latest observations. Hopefully we'll have some talkback reports as well, see what people have been seeing. We've been hearing from a few camps this summer. We've got a family that regularly checks in, and you can always let us know what you're seeing too.
Yeah. And I'm out and about much more, and it's the reports from other people and John that are like, oh, I should be on the lookout for, these. And we had a guest this weekend who was very into like flowers. And mm-hmm. So there are even a lot of things on my usual walk trail. Like I've tried to be more like mindful of what's there. But her eye, she was like, oh, what are these like little white flowers? And it's like, what? And then I'm like, oh, sure enough, there are little white flowers that are in bloom. And when we drove up Lake Superior, is that the lupins or lupines?
Mm-hmm.
I love them. They're
like the purple or sometimes they're pink, but they're just like, you have they're cool. I can't describe them, but
they kind of look like giant like cones, like they're kind of cone shaped, like big,
yeah,
but, colored. I don't know, they're just beautiful,
and they tend to grow in ditches. And drove down to the cities a few weekends ago and weeks ago, and was noticing them further south or as we were going, and very cool.
Yeah, and one of the bike trails we were on, there was milkweed, and like the milkweed like flowers are kind of round,
like puffy, like pink
balls, and
those
were there. But and I stopped and looked at one hoping that I'd see the caterpillars, because like last summer there was on my usual walk path that I have, there was, I think Marshall had made the comment that they were seeing a ton of caterpillars on the milkweed. I did not see any on these particular ones, but I'm hoping that they're there, because I don't think people have been seeing a ton of monarchs.
No, I have not. I don't think I've seen any.
Yeah. So I don't know. So let us know. That'll be something you can, ask John Latimer if others are seeing that.
Yeah. Yep, we'll have a lot of fun tomorrow. I'll be his co-host again this week. So stay tuned for that. Right now, though, it is time for a rebroadcast of Tammy Bobrowski's conversation with Minnesota writer Kent Nurburn about his novel Lone Dog Road. It is a redemptive journey set in the sometimes harsh but beautiful South Dakota prairies.
Kent Nerburn is the Minnesota author of several books on spirituality and Native American themes, including the internationally acclaimed biography, Neither Wolf Nor Dog. His new novel is called Lone Dog Road. This story revolves around two young Lakota brothers on the run from a boarding school government agent. They journey across the prairies of South Dakota in search of pipestone in Minnesota to replace their great-grandfather's sacred pipe, broken by that government agent. Born out of the pandemic and inspired by an old photograph of a young Ojibwe boy, this is the book Kent had always wanted to write. In our What We're Reading conversation, Kent Nerburn describes more about how Lone Dog Road came to be.
It actually took shape out of several separate events. One is there, back when I worked at Red Lake, we did a book of oral history, and that the students and I went out to various museums and historical centers looking for photographs. And there was one photograph in one of the, I don't even remember which museum or which historical society was in, of a boy sitting in a rocking chair. And he was, I'm sure he was an Ojibwe boy. He was about 11 or 12. And he was staring right at the camera, which was kind of unusual. And it must have been, it was a grainy old photograph. But he was looking at me. I mean, this is a sort of a strange psychic connection, but I felt like he was looking right at the camera and I was looking back at him. And he always remained in my memory as sort of an indictment of what we had done as a nation to the Native people, as well as a challenge. And he was a little person. He was a personage in my psyche. And along came the pandemic. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do during the pandemic. And I said, this is a chance for me to write the book that I wanted to write. I wanted to write a book that was a pure novel and was inhabited by people that I cared about, was a story that I cared about. And I wanted to tell a story that carried Indian values inside of it. I'm a great believer that there's much in the Native way of thinking that we as a dominant culture really need to introduce into our way of understanding the world. So anyway, along came the pandemic, and I said, the book I'd like to write is really a story about, I have to just sort of invent a story and build a story around characters who walk through the Native world and non-Native people and Natives and everyone coming from their own point of view of struggling with the issues of life. And this little boy was the starting point. That image of that boy just haunted me. And I said, he's going to be one of my main characters. So he became the inspiration for Levi, the older of the boys in the book. And it, you know, it's really a story of two little guys, 1'11 and 1'6, who set off running after their great-grandfather's chanumpa, their sacred pipe, was broken by a government agent who has come to take the younger boy off to boarding school. And so the story is really the story of their journey to Pipestone to attempt to try to get some more, a piece of Pipestone to make a new pipe for their great-grandfather.
I'd love to talk about the characters more, especially how the story revolves around the two brothers. Mm-hmm. You've got us set up in South Dakota, the summer of 1950. What else would you want readers to know about Levi and Reuben going into the novel?
Well, Levi, at 11, he's searching for manhood. He's very young, but he wants to become a man. Like a lot of kids, he's trying to, live bigger than he is. He feels really responsible for his little brother, Reuben. Reuben is, the way I describe him is he's, as the Native people would say, he's other-minded. I've always been fascinated with children who, in our contemporary parlance, are somewhere on, you know, the spectrum, or are autistic, or have that absolutely unusual dimension that allows them to understand the world in a way that the rest of us don't, and very often have talents and skills that are, you know, that are mystifying. And we tend to see these people as having some sort of a pathology, something that needs to be addressed and corrected or accounted for. Whereas in the Native world, these people have a special talent, they have a special gift, and it's need to be honored and protected. Like his brother says, he remembers numbers. He's able to remember songs after hearing them once and sing them exactly. He has an insight into things without really understanding, like an animal. He watches, and he doesn't necessarily understand the way we do, but he sees the world through a completely different set of eyes. And his older brother, the great-grandfather, tells his older brother, Levi, you're going to be responsible for your little brother always, because that's the challenge and gift you've been given in life. And so that's really what makes Levi try to act as an adult. He wants to be a man in becoming.
So moving on to some of the themes in the book, there is a tension in the story between Christianity and Native American spirituality, given the history of what children went through in the Indian boarding schools. Can you talk about that balance between Christianity and Lakota ways in Lone Dog Road?
I have a basic belief that we are spiritual, we're believing creatures, and that the world is larger than we understand, and that there is a spiritual dimension to life that all of us participate in, even if we don't necessarily recognize it. And that's really the nature of the journey that everyone goes on in this book. All of the stories weave together to reveal what is a larger meaning in the whole journey that they participate in. And if there's a message in the book that I try to convey through all the characters, is that there is this something larger. There is this mystery at the heart of life that we all participate in, and that we don't necessarily know what it is. And it sometimes reveals itself and it sometimes doesn't. And the course of this book, all of the stories weave together to reveal what is a larger meaning in the whole journey that they participate in. But I have no desire to disparage or minimize anyone's belief. I just think that we need to have a larger embrace and have a larger understanding of mystery, a larger understanding of God, a larger understanding of faith, and that all of the characters participate in this larger understanding in the course of the book.
This is What We're Reading, and we are talking with Minnesota writer Kent Nerburn. His new novel is called Lone Dog Road. Kent, another really powerful theme in this book is the land. It has such a presence in the story, and as well as the elements, the weather, the region during the time period in your book, they are going through a terrible drought. The crops are wiped out. There are dust storms. Farm animals are suffering. The characters in the story speak to the land and weather almost as if it were a living, breathing entity. I wonder if you can talk more about what the land means to the story.
Well, the land is always a character in all of my books, and it's in some ways the dominant character. And this is one of the great things about being able to bring this book to the North Country, that in the time that I lived in Bemidji and in the area, nature is bigger than culture. Anyone who lives is close to the immediate power of nature in northern Minnesota understands that nature and the forces of nature are a primary player in our life. They are the characters that shape our lives. And so in all my books, the land or the weather or some aspect of nature have been characters. And in this book, it's a unifier. I love the Dakotas. Something about the Dakotas fascinated me. I remember when I first moved to Bemidji in the mid-80s, I always thought, well, I was going to be going up, I'd go up to the Northeast into the canoe country, loons and canoes, and, you know, all of the sort of mythic reality of the boundary waters. But I found myself drawn to the West, drawn to the Dakotas, drawn to that singularity of the land where, as in one of the books, one of the people says that a woman almost goes out of her mind out on the prairies because she says the moon is the largest thing here. And that feeling of the meditative aspect of a world that is very singular just caught to me. The sense of space, the sense of weather. When you start to feel winter coming there in the Bemidji area and there in North Country, you feel it coming from the Northwest. It's like a drumbeat that you don't quite hear, like the approach of a distant army. And I've always wanted people to understand that power of nature. And in this case, the power of nature, I wanted to honor the Dakotas, because the Dakotas for me, especially North Dakota, even though I set this in South Dakota, the Dakotas have a power that just has a real hold over me. And it is that singularity and that dominance. And the sky is so much larger than you stand in front of it and you're diminished. You become small in the face of the very great forces. And I wanted these people to be present. They were standing in front of the setting of the of nature, but nature was controlling almost everything they were doing. Mm-hmm.
So Kent, I was able to read the book before we talked, and I have to admit that in the beginning, I was so worried that something really terrible was going to happen to these two beautiful boys. And that somehow framed how I was trying to read the book. And I skipped ahead a little bit, like just to see what the outcome was going to be. And then I relaxed more because I realized like nothing terrible was going to happen to them. Because for some reason, I think it's the times we're in, like I feel something terrible is going to happen to everybody. So once I was able to relax, I just kind of got into the pace and the journey of the book. And it's beautiful.
That really gives me a good place to leave, because something I didn't say when I talked about the pandemic and our isolations and separations, I really set out to write a redemptive book. Wanted it to, there is so much darkness in us right now, so much anger. I mean, it's not a good time to be an American. And I don't like the growing cruelty at the heart of our national character. I don't like the adversarial nature, the anger that's in all of us. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to write a book that was redemptive. And so that was the goal. And to have the boys' journey be redeemed at the end, hopefully people get done and they have a sense of hope as a result of having read the book, not merely a discovery of more cruelty and harshness in the world, but instead that there's a common humanity that, even though it's different in all of us, that in the end it comes out that we're on a hopeful journey. At least that's my goal, is to tell a hopeful journey.
Kent Nerburn's new novel is called Lone Dog Road. It's what we're reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski.